the shining sea throughout the solar system and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
To the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It's Wednesday, right? And this is what people normally call hump day, because it's the middle of the week. We're over the hump. We're headed towards the weekend after tonight. Well, we're here each and every day, and we're here because you have a right to know, and because you matter. And it's very, very important that you understand how this show works. So if you're new to the show, if you don't know how this works, here's how it works. I don't have an agenda that I'm pushing. So I don't try to convince you to think like I think. I'll tell you how I think. But I'm not trying to get you to think like I think. I'm trying only to put information in front of you and get you to think about it and ask questions, examine it, come up with your own determination as to whether you think that information is accurate or not. So that means that I never, ever, ever know what a guest is going to say. We don't pre-script anything. And this guest that's with us tonight has been with us before. I think he will tell you we don't pre-script anything. Now, we do pick topics that we're going to talk about. But I don't try to find out what they're going to say about that topic. So I find out when you find out. And I will do my best to ask the questions I think you would ask. But it's only one brain here, you know, and so I can't think of all the questions, and we'll be opening the telephone lines later in the show for you to call in with your questions and your comments, and man, I'll tell you, the questions and comments that people call in with, lots of times, it's like, wow, I didn't think of that. That's cool. That's a good one, you know. So get your dialing finger ready to do its thing, and when we open the telephone lines later in the show, you can give us a call and ask those questions and open my eyes and my mind. We have here at the Kevin Smith Show a free newsletter. That newsletter is called The K-Files. It comes out every 2 weeks, and it's absolutely free. We've been publishing the K-Files since back in 2000 when the show first began. And we have people subscribed now that subscribed back then because it's good. I'd like for you to be getting it, and I think you'll enjoy it. All you have to do to get it is click on my website where it says K-Files. All right, just click that. Subscribe, you'll automatically get an email with a link in it that you have to click to activate that subscription. That's how we make sure that we don't spam anybody. But if you do that, you can do it right now during the show. If you do that, then you'll be on the list for us to send this next edition of the K-Files to, and that comes out on Friday, this Friday. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this. All of the music used here at the Kevin Smith Show is from independent artists. Most of it from independent artists at musicalley.com. Go over to musicalley.com. Check out thousands of artists and thousands of great independent tunes. Musicalley.com.
I was born in the country, raised on a farm. Mama always said, son, don't do no harm. Someday you're gonna find you a wife. Everything's gonna change in your life. You gotta know how to treat her, how to talk to a girl. Gotta let her know that she was your entire world. In the bar, some of the girls were dressed in the nines, and some of the girls were barely wearing the time. Went to a rock and roll concert that night, and the girl on guitar was a supercharged sight. Yeah! God, can't take her. Two-fisted, stogie-smoking woman. Don't take no crap from anyone. Got a tattoo of a spider right up on her nose. Breaks hard bricks between her toes. If you plan on causing problems, better think again, cause she will break your face with a wink and a grin. She's a rock and roll diva. She's shredded like a demon gone wild. She ain't no princess wearing diamonds and gowns. When she walks out on the stage, she's gonna own your town. She's a hard rocking, two-fisted, stoker, smoker woman. And she's a goddess with a guitar. She's a rock and roll diva. She can shred like a demon gone wild.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, well, my guest this evening is William Michael Mott. He has been with us on a number of occasions before. He's been with us as a guest on this show. He's also been a speaker when we were doing the iConferences. And, you know, we got a lot of positive feedback each and every time he has appeared. So he's back with us tonight, and he's got a very, very busy schedule these days. I will let him tell us about that. William Michael Mott, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be here.
since we had you on the show last, you have begun working on a master's degree.
Yeah, that's a whole other incarnation, though. That's not involved with the stuff that people generally know me for, so I'll probably not even go that route tonight.
Yeah, but I want people to know that. I want people to know.
I appreciate it.
Because it's a master's degree in art education, right?
Right.
Okay, so because we are going to talk about your art some tonight.
Right.
There are a few people out there who do art that's in our genre, folks. And you need to know about them. Michael is not just, there's no such thing as just an artist or just a this or just a that. Every single person you know is multi-layered, and they do many, many things. But Michael is an artist and a good one. And he's a researcher. He's an author. He's a public speaker. Are you doing radio these days, Michael?
Yes, Kevin. I have a show called Unraveling the Secrets. I believe you were on there sometime back, but it's still going. It's every Saturday night over at unravelingthesecrets.com, and it goes for 2 hours. It mm-hmm. comes on at 11 Central, so it'd be midnight Eastern time, and it goes for 2 hours.
Okay.
So every Saturday night, unravelingthesecrets.com.
9 o'clock out on the West Coast.
Right. And by the way, some of your listeners may be familiar with Tim Schwartz, a great researcher and writer, and Tim is my co-host on that show.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
All right. Michael, there's a book that you published that has been out for a while, but it's about to be republished. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I had a previous publisher, and we had a parting of the ways, and I wasn't satisfied with a lot of things that were going on with that relationship, so that had to end. And I have a new publisher, which I've had for about a year and a half now. He's doing a really great job of getting all my books back out and in superior editions, higher quality, lower cost. You know, so there's a new edition of a book coming out. And actually what this book is a book about a very controversial writer and artist named Richard S. Shaver. Some people know Shaver as the creator of the so-called Shaver Mystery. But he was also a science fiction writer, a struggling pulp writer back during the heyday of the pulps. In fact, that's where the whole Shaver Mystery thing got started, was in Amazing Stories, and where he wrote these stories and sent them to Ray Palmer, and Ray Palmer embellished them, and they claimed it was all true. But Shaver really did believe this stuff was true. And he had some really strange experiences, which some people think may have given a credence to some of his beliefs. Now, whether you believe it's paranormal or it's purely materialistic like he believed, you know, that's up to you to decide, or if it's just coincidence, that's up to you to decide. But he did a lot of really strange artwork. He would take rocks that he claimed were ancient holographic records that he had found, these libraries of these holographic records that had just been reduced to rubble from an ancient civilization, and he would take his rock saw and just saw them in thin slices. Then he would shine light through them onto a photosensitive surface, a canvas, masonite that he had coated with special coating, or even a photographic paper. And he would create these really astonishing transparent images. And he claimed that inside these images, you could see like glimpses out of this recorded data that was in the rock. Of course, you know, in his time, he didn't use the word holography, recorded data, stuff like that. He called them rock books, rock records. He had his own name for them, rock photos, rock photos, all this other stuff. But he was a very interesting guy, and it sometime back I came into possession of some material that he had sent to Ray Palmer, who was the editor of Amazing Stories back in the old days, and it was the editor that kind of got him going. Now, Ray was the guy that came up with a lot of different magazines down through the years, Flying Saucer Magazine, Search, Fate Magazine. He started all those magazines. And he would kind of keep the Shaver Mystery going. In fact, at times, the Shaver Mystery was the main thing that those magazines focused on. And in Richard Shaver's personal cosmology, I guess you could call it, he claimed that beings still lived inside the Earth that were descended from people who fled beneath the surface during a cataclysm thousands of years ago. He often referred to it as the flood or the deluge. He said that these beings were not human like we are, and that they had fled beneath the surface of the earth, and that these rock books were records of their existence when they were on the surface. And so I obtained some stuff that had come from Ray's estate, and they were things that Richard Shaver had sent to Ray Palmer to propose book ideas and other things. And a lot of them were these rock book slices that he had sent. They were a whole bunch of transparencies, or I should say photo exposures, that he had sent to him. And I scanned these things in high resolution in Photoshop, and I found some pretty astonishing stuff.
Like what? Give us an example.
Well, you know, you have to ask yourself how much of it's pareidolia, which is, you know, pareidolia is where the human eye and mind, you perceive patterns, you know, whether they're there or not. Like when you look at linoleum tile and you see faces, or you look at the wood grain and you see the devil, or you look at a cloud and you see a puppy, you know. Mm-hmm. These are examples of how the human brain attempts to find patterns in random data. And this is something that, you know, even happens in the animal kingdom, which is why you have things like, you know, moths and butterflies that open their wings up and you see eyes, things like that. In order to scare off their predators, or maybe they've evolved that way to scare off the predators, without, you know, of course, no conscious effort on their part, or a creator, you know, however you want to believe it. But, you know, the human mind finds patterns, and the human eye does. And so when you look at these things, though, you'll see some things that are pretty strange. They're almost too strange. Maybe some of them are pareidolia, but some of these things are so bizarre that you have to really ask yourself as to what these are. So in this new release of this book, there's a bunch of that stuff. There's an actual scanned copy with an additional transcript of a facsimile book that Shaver put together using old Xerox machines, back when Xerox was the only game in town for copiers. And this would have been in the very early 70s. And he had painstakingly pasted this thing together and written in it and pasted photos of himself and these rock books in there and different things. And so, you know, that's in there. It's an account of what he believes was going on.
Okay, well, let's back up for just a minute. Pick one. You know, you said you took some of these rock transparencies or prints or whatever, and have put them in your book. And are they in color there, you say?
No, actually, this book is in black and white because everything that he had that I came into possession of was in black and white.
Okay. Let me ask you about, just pick one of those that you find pretty amazing and describe for us what's in it.
Well, you know, there are some things that, just like little faces peering out of holes in the ground and figures jumping and running and shouting and waving. But the strangest thing I found were things like, there's a picture that looks exactly like, I mean, photographically like a kneeling woman in something similar to a kimono, and she's kind of turned three quarters away from the viewer, and it looks like a woman kneeling, complete with kimono, headdress, everything. There's another image that's similar, which looks like you're looking down at a seated woman who's nude. Okay, but it looks like an actual photograph. There are several images like that come out so clearly that you have to wonder, now, is this something that was actually in the rock data? Well, it seems to be, because I scanned the exposures. And I scanned them at a very high resolution. So I don't think this is something he did necessarily, or that he did himself in the dark room, because his dark room was pretty crude. I mean, he was basically living in a shotgun shack when he did all this stuff.
And that was in the days before home computers and Photoshop.
Oh, yes. This would have been in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Middle to late 60s and very early 70s. Some of the other material that's in there are letters that he wrote, articles that he wrote for fanzines, which are very obscure, about his beliefs about the ancient world and the civilizations that existed then. His own experiences that he claims he had with these non-human beings in the caves. And, you know, all this type of stuff. And, you know, you look at his material and you say, well, you know, this guy was paranoid. He was possibly schizophrenic. He needed medication. Whether that's true or not, what he had to say is very eerie, because if you go all the way back to the beginning of ufology, you'll find that Richard Shaver predated everything from the abduction side of it to the UFOs themselves. Before Kenneth Arnold ever saw, you know, the flying, I don't guess they're really saucers, they were more like boomerangs, but before he saw the ships that he saw, Shaver was talking about these metal ships that were in the caves that belonged to the ancients that could fly. and how some of them were disc shaped, some of them were wing shaped, and this was several years before Arnold's sighting. So, you know, you have to ask yourself how much of what Shaver claimed was something he based on his own experience, and how much of it was confabulation, or you know, some sort of what's the word, scream memory, for you know, for whatever had happened to him. Because if you look at his material, it sort of has a Pulp Fiction trapping to it. It's as if, in order to deal with whatever it was, he tried to wrap it in whatever was the current, you know, hot thing of the day, which in his, at his time would have been pulp science fiction. And at that time, pulp science fiction was kind of looked on as lowbrow stuff. But as we know now, you know, it kind of has formed our entire pop culture to this point. And Shaver was very much a part of that. I mean, if you look at even, for instance, the original Star Trek episode, The Menagerie, that basically is a complete ripoff of Richard Shaver's stories. I mean, you have these subterranean humanoids who have degenerated. They're looking for fresh stock to replenish their race or to repopulate the planet. They can create holographic images, illusions. You know, they got death rays. They live underground. All these things that are in that story are basically, they basically come straight out of the so-called Shaver mystery. So he had a huge impact on science fiction, on popular culture, and the guy really never got a break when he was alive. He was just constantly vilified, ridiculed. I mean, it almost caused a war in science fiction fandom, this whole Shaver mystery thing. So, you know, what I've tried to do with this book, and this is an even more in-depth version of the book, is show what Shaver thought. You know, I don't call myself the author of this particular book, unlike my other books. I say I'm the editor and the compiler of this book, because the material in the book, aside from my intro, is all Shaver. It's all his writings from different magazines that he had done, fanzines, his images that he created. He even has a thing on how to find these images, how to find the rocks, how to create, how to look for these things and find them, create your photo exposures and all this stuff. So it's pretty interesting, you know. It's one of those things where you look at it and you think, well, maybe this one's legit. Don't know about this one. But it does give you a good insight into how this man thought. You know, now he's being sort of held up as what's called an outsider artist. You know, there have been shows of his work in different places and things like this, because he also did paintings based on these rock slices. But he never really got any attention while he was alive, other than mostly negative attention. So hopefully this is one of those things which will give people a unique look into a person from American history, from science fiction history, UFO history, paranormal history, that they may not have known about or they may not know much about. You know, Richard believed purely in materialism. He was a hard materialist. He claimed everything was completely 100% real, solid. It factually happened. It happened to him. But Ray Palmer, who had become friends with Shaver after many years of working together, and they sort of had a love-hate relationship going, but Palmer believed, after long decades of this stuff and his own experiences as a result of dealing with Shaver, he had some strange experiences, and he believed that this was all astral. It was all, you know, spiritual. It was all something to do with what he called the lower astral level, and that's where all the stuff was taking place. So it's got a lot of interesting history to it.
And, all right, so let me ask you a question about Shaver, because obviously you have read all of this stuff because you had to edit it. And compile it for the book, and I would suspect there's probably a lot of stuff that of Shaver's that didn't make it to the book. But you've got a pretty good grasp on this guy now because of reading his own stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And viewing his pictures. So let me ask you: you mentioned a moment ago that some people may think the guy is paranoid or schizophrenic. Or what do you think? What do you think about the guy?
I think that it's like a lot of people that have these experiences. You know, you have to ask yourself how much really happened to these people, and how much of it is something happened and then the imagination takes over, or they try to make sense of it themselves in terms that only they can understand, or in terms that allow them to deal with it. I think that's what Shaver did. I think whatever happened, he tried to deal with it in his own way. And so he tried to find ways to explain whatever it was. Now, whether it was something to do with his stay in mental hospital, which he did have at one point, but you know, if you look at that, it ends up that his wife's very powerful family had him locked up because he was going to divorce her, and other things like this. So, you know, there's a lot more, always more to the story. But supposedly, this all came about because of an electromagnetic disturbance that he experienced. He was working as a welder, and he started hearing these voices while he was working as a welder, running these old-timey welding rigs and other types of electrical equipment, and he started hearing these voices. And he said that's when he first started hearing these things. So, you know, again, you have this whole electromagnetic component, and that seems to come out again and again, not just in his story, but as you know, in a lot of paranormal activity and reports, there seems to be an electromagnetic connection a lot of the time. So, who knows? I mean, maybe something happened to him. The question is, how much of it was actually, you know, an objective thing that happened to him, and how much of it was completely subjective in that he kind of took it and ran with it. But whatever it was, my gut feeling is that it scared him very badly, and that's one of the reasons that he approached it the way he did, because he wanted to, you know. In fact, his first story was called A Warning to Future Man. So,
well, I have a little bit of a theory, and I've had it for some time, about the deal with electromagnetic fields and the effects that they have on people. And I've heard it described, you know, they hear voices. That's one of the symptoms. And I've heard it that this is imaginary. I mean, you're actually hearing them, but they're not really there. It's being caused by the electromagnetic field interacting with your brain. I think there's a possibility that they really are there and being carried on the electromagnetic field like a radio carries my
sure.
voice. And, you know, maybe it's not somebody broadcasting. It's just you and me sitting, having a cup of coffee, talking. But somehow what we're saying is being picked up by an electromagnetic field and broadcast into somebody's
right.
head.
I think that's
a possibility.
That's basically what Shaver was saying, but you know, that he was accidentally hearing this stuff,
mm-hmm.
At least at first.
All right, we have to take a break, and we'll be back right after this break, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, William Michael Mott. And at the moment, we're talking about the subject of... it's not a new book, but then again it is, because it's expanded. And it's being republished. And if you go to my website, folks, and scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show. If you click on that picture, it'll take you to Michael's website. And I suppose, Michael, that's where all the information about getting the book and all that, that's going to be on that website, right?
Well, it will be in the next couple of days. It's not out yet. It will be out probably by the weekend sometime, hopefully. It's already out in ebook form. It's been out in ebook form for some time, but this is the print version. And I've been looking over the proof, you know, the PDF proof and everything. It looks great. It's going to be really, really nice. Also, if they go to the website, they can see my other books. I have, you know, of course, Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures, which is sort of my magnum opus when it comes to this kind of stuff. Some other books, some fiction stuff, a couple of novels, which are published together. It's called the Pulsifer Saga Omnibus Edition or Illustrated Edition, and that's a lot of fun. I just have a lot of stuff there they can look at. But also, there's a new art thing I'm doing, as you and I had talked about earlier, and the link to that is there too. So there's a lot of stuff to look at there.
Okay, and for those who are listening, first, if you're listening, then listen carefully. Go to my website and scroll down to the picture about tonight's show. That's one of his pieces of art in the background. And then just click on it, and it'll take you there. But go ahead and tell us the URL for that web address.
Sure. It's basically very simple. It's motimorphic.com. It's MOTTIMORPHIC. Kind of like metamorphic. MOTTIMORPHIC, motimorphic.com. And like you said, it's there at your website. If they click on it, it'll take them there. And it's pretty simple. And pretty much everything I've done or that I'm doing right now is linked from that site. And like I said, the new book announcement will be up there in the next few days. And the art announcement's there now. So if they want to go look, they can go check out the artwork, which is now offered a variety of formats.
Fantastic. We're going to get into the artwork here in just a little bit. And talk about it, but I invite everybody to go take a look at the art. Click on that link and go over there and take a look at the art. But I want to go back to Shaver for a moment. It's pretty interesting that a guy that was people worked overtime to sideline this guy when he was alive.
They did.
It's pretty interesting that a guy like that is now sort of beginning to gain some traction. And a lot of people have read the Shaver story about the inner earth and really think that it's right on, that it's right on target. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, ufology is filled with it. I mean, it runs the gamut. If you read, you know, the abduction literature, there are many accounts of people claiming they were taken to a subterranean world or a subterranean area or an underground base, a cavern, you know, on and on. But if you look at this stuff and you look at it in terms of archetypes, this goes all the way back, you know, and that's what I look at in Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures. All of these archetypes, modern-day paranormal stuff or fringe material, it's nothing new. I mean, people think this is all new and just incredible, but basically this is the same stuff that's been in every folklore system going all the way back to the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, this is something that's been around for, you know, 6,000 years, and it's the same stories. It's the same activities in terms of these non-human beings. It's nothing new. It's just that our interpretation of whatever this is seems to change. And these archetypes are basically always the same. And, Shaver kind of tapped into that, I think. You know, he had a lot of other things going on. I think that if you really start reading what he wrote, he had some personal issues, which he confabulated things, and he projected some of his personal neuroses, I think, into what he was saying. But, you know, who doesn't do that? I mean, I think a lot of writers do that, even so-called nonfiction writers.
It's pretty impossible to write a book that's not coming out of your mind.
Well, you've got to try to be objective as much as you can.
Yeah.
I think that the problem the problem with Shaver was he felt like he was on a mission. He had to warn everybody. You know, he had to give you the lowdown on what's really going on, that kind of thing. There are other people like that right now, you know, as you well know, in the mm-hmm. conspiracy and paranormal and UFO field that just, you know, they're just filled with panic and fear, and they, you know, they want to tell you what's going on. But the thing is that whatever is going on has been going on for a very long time, and you and I have talked about that before. You know, it's nothing new. And what changes is our interpretation and how we try to deal with it. You know, I think that...
Well, it's kind of like this NSA thing, man.
Yeah.
People, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, my God, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
absolutely nothing new about it. It's been going on. We've talked, yep. You and I have talked about it. I've talked about it on the show. The only thing that's new about it is it hit the front pages of a major newspaper overseas, and it exposed it to the world.
Right.
I think the world finally has awakened.
For how long?
Not for long, but I think they have awakened. To the fact that this is, you know, this is not Superman's America, you know,
no.
Truth, justice, and the American way. This is more Gestapo America. And now it's exposed to the world. But those of us living here, we knew it, and, you know, we've talked about it.
Yeah, it's not new.
We've
seen it coming for a long time. We knew it was going on, like you said. I mean, I can remember... 6, 7, 8 years ago, you and I talking about it, that this was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it surprises me how stunned everybody is that it's going on. Because, you know, it's just like so many other things. Those of us that talk about these topics, we're called conspiracy nuts, conspiracy theorists, paranoid. And then we always end up being right. Sooner or later, it always comes true. And this isn't the only thing, you know, that fits that description. So... You know, you hate to say, it's like I said on my Facebook page, when do we get to say I told you so?
I don't even care about that anymore.
I find it amusing, okay?
Yeah, you know, when people wake up.
I mean, I'm outraged, but I was already outraged. Or not just really outraged so much now, it's just like, you know, I have dull disgust. Let's put it that way.
Well,
sort of a throbbing disgust, you know.
Well, you know, my reaction to it all now is all the people having an oh my God moment over this. Welcome to the world of open eyes. And I hear people say, well, we got to do something about this. Ladies and gentlemen, you're 30 to 50 years, way too freaking late.
Anything like this that you get to know about, whatever's really going on is decades beyond what you think is going on.
That's right.
That, you know, anything in the military, anything in, you know, high technology, this covert, anything like this is so far beyond what you're hearing about now that you're outraged about. I mean, there's no telling what's really going on that you're not even going to know about. And then, there again, you know, people say, well, that's paranoia. You know, that's a conspiracy. That's a fact. I mean, look at the Skunk Works, that whole thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you.
That's true.
And the one thing that this exposure in the newspaper has done is it has awakened some folks to the fact that they're not out to get you. They got you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, I mean, that's it. They've got you.
Well,
but anyway.
Here's what I'm hoping, Kevin. Mm-hmm. I hope that what this does is it gets rid of this whole party mentality that people have in this country. You know, left versus right, us versus them, you know, liberals and conservatives. And I'm fairly conservative in some ways, but some ways I'm not. You know, I'm a libertarian.
I'm a Kevinist.
Yeah, exactly, a human. I'm a conservative libertarian, but I'm a libertarian. And what I'm hoping will come out of this is that the outcry will be equal from both sides. I'm not quite seeing it yet, but I think it's getting there. I think it's getting there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of like, and we've talked about this before, I think, that, you know, like Machiavelli, you know, wrote about, he said, if you want to rule effectively, you divide the populace, but you artificially divide yourself into two camps, and then you create issues that you fight about publicly. You get the population to take one side or the other. You keep them divided, and while everybody's divided behind closed doors, both of the so-called different sides are actually working together to do something completely different that nobody is going to know about, something that's really going to shaft everybody.
Yeah.
And that's basically what he told his nephews to do. And if I'm sorry, I mean, George Washington warned us about the dangers of a two-party system. In his closing speech, he said, you know, that he was fearful that that was what would bring down the Republic. Until we wake up from that, you know, I don't know how much effective change we can do, but I'm hoping that this is one of those things that kind of pushes people to say, you know, it's time to stop looking at this just as my party this and my party that. You know, we all have rights to believe different things. That's part of what being an American is about. That's what people seem to be losing. They're becoming so
They're polarized.
Polarized. Yeah. Polarized. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to get back to Shaver, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We kind of departed there by me using that as an example that this isn't anything new. And what Shaver wrote about, it's not anything new. It just has his particular spin on it, his particular flavor.
It does, but it also had what he claimed was hard evidence, which were his rock books. And unlike a lot of other people, he was trying to really back up what he was saying. Some of the stuff was pretty weird. I mean, he came up with some pretty strange imagery out of these.
I wonder how many people even knew. I think a lot of people know the basic story about his visit to the inner earth and so forth. A lot of people know that story, but I wonder how many people knew about this rock art.
Back in the old days, a lot of people knew about it, and they laughed at it a lot. Nowadays, not as many know about it. And, you know, the people think that Shaver was a hollow earth guy. He was not a hollow earth guy. He didn't believe in the hollow earth, really. He was more of a cavern world guy. He believed that there were these vast cavern systems beneath the earth that were occupied, at least some of them were, by these survivors of this planetary cataclysm. He said a lot of things that were very interesting. Before anybody else, before science even came out with this, he claimed that these beings had fled because the radiation from the sun became deadly and their lifespan started getting shorter and shorter, and they went beneath the earth to survive. Now, if you read, you know, for instance, a lot of different ancient systems of belief, the Old Testament, for instance, you have this thing about the flood, you know, and there was a firmament above the earth, and the firmament was above the sky. It says that in Genesis, and it was made out of water. And when the flood happened, the shell of water kind of got to shaking because of whatever happened, and it fell to the ground simultaneously with what were called the fountains of the deep bursting forth. It says the windows of heaven opened, the water fell, the firmament fell, and that the fountains of the deep burst forth. So you had some sort of an event that may have been the passage of a large planetary body, a gravitational pull that disrupted the stability of our planetary system. And then after, you read, you know, in the Old Testament, that after that happened, each successive generation that was listed of people, the lifespan got shorter and shorter.
It specifically states, there's a verse that specifically states that, now this is the Old Testament, so you've got God in there, and he specifically says that, he's going to turn down the lifespan to 120 years. And then later, you have another statement where he says he's turning it down to 70 years. Mm-hmm. And basically, that's where it has remained. Some people outlive that, but average lifespan is right in that neighborhood.
That's right. And you know, another thing about that is when Shaver wrote this stuff, he said that before the flood, and he called it the flood sometimes, he said before this happened.
Okay, hold that thought. We have to take a break. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back, and we'll find out what Shaver said about before the flood.
Love.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. Well, we're not into the second hour. You know, this is the second time within the last 2 weeks that it's done that. What it's done is it just played the break that's supposed to happen right before the second hour. So anyway, if you're just now joining us, welcome. My guest this evening is William Michael Mott. And Mike is talking with us about, we've been talking about Shaver, Richard Shaver, and Shaver and his writings and photographs are, that's the stuff of the book that Mike has written and or that he's compiled and that's being republished this week. And so we're talking about some of that. Now, we had mentioned just before the break that Shaver had some things to say about, you know, he talked about the flood a lot, the right. deluge, the cataclysm. And you were about to say, you said, as a matter of fact, Shaver said that people before the flood, and then we had to go to right. break.
Well, he said that, you know, that they lived for thousands of years and that, you know, after the flood that their lifespan started decreasing. He claimed that, as he put it, the sun became poisonous and that a lot of what happened was that these people that saw themselves as superior, the elite, maybe partially non-human according to what he wrote, part human, part something else, they fled beneath the earth to survive. And that the rest of us poor everyday Joes and Jane Does or whatever, we're left out here to fend for ourselves in a new savage world. And we had to contend with the radiation from the sun that the people inside the earth didn't have to contend with. The downside to this was that after they went underground, they still live longer, but there's radiation, there's effects to living underground that caused them to mutate, to degenerate in some ways mentally, and not in terms of becoming dumb, but in terms of their sanity and their capacity for compassion and you know, dealing fairly with other people, including us, and that they even have wars, you know, among themselves as a result of this, but they like to torment people on the surface of the earth. This was something that he wrote about. And if you read, for instance, in the apocryphal books of the Bible, which of course were taken out, but things like the Book of Jasher, the Book of Jubilees, of course the Book of Enoch, which Christ and his disciples quote directly from the Book of Enoch in about four different places in the New Testament. So, you know, decide for yourself if it's inspired of Christ and Timothy and Jude quote from it, you know, people that are out there. But anyway, you know, these books talk about the angels who kept not their first estate, who interbred with people, and they had these hybrid children, and they were, as a result, the ones that were not killed in the flood, in the cataclysm, they were locked under the earth. And that's what Jude's talking about when he says the angels who are reserved in chains of darkness till the judgment of the great day. That entire passage is lifted from the Book of Enoch, which actually was written about 300 years before the Book of Jude or the Epistle of Jude. So, you know, these are themes that Shaver was repeating. And they're themes that don't just exist in, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition. They're themes that go back to ancient Sumeria or Sumer.
Well, it's really interesting, too.
Everywhere you find them.
It's very interesting. You're saying, you know, that he lifted these concepts right out of, for instance, Jude.
He lifted them from there. I think that these are just archetypal concepts that are everywhere.
Where did he get them from?
Every belief system has them.
Yeah, where did he get it from?
That's a good question.
Because if he lifted it out of Jude and even Enoch, that's very interesting because he was such a materialist.
He was an atheist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was an atheist. And in fact, he would become greatly infuriated by anybody who tried to equate this with either religion or mysticism in any way.
I find it interesting because, you know, it is possible for some people, it's just totally impossible. They pick up a Bible, that's a religious book, period.
Right.
And they read all kinds of religion into everything that's said there. And I'm not saying, folks, I'm not saying that it's not a holy book, all right? If you think it's a holy book, I got no problem with that. But at the base, you got to say it's a collection of 66 ancient documents. And it is possible to read it without any religious overtones to it and just see what does the document say.
Well, that is possible. It is a historical document.
Well, a lot of it is.
I mean archaeology has proven that time and time again, that things that people scoffed about, you know, in both Old and New Testament, and then they find the site, you know, they find the evidence that this actually happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it is a historical document to some extent. I mean, mm-hmm. I happen to think it's to a great extent, but I think a lot of ancient books are, like, I think that the Puranas are historical documents. They talk about the same stuff. They talk about a time before a cataclysm and a war, basically what sounds like nuclear war, mm-hmm. Beings that were part human, part non-human, beings that now live beneath the earth because they fled to beneath the earth. Now they have a civilization there. I mean, it's the same stuff in every belief system. You know, in the medieval Christian sense, and by me in the literal medieval sense, you know, they believed in devils that lived under the ground, and these weren't just spirits. They believed it's, you know, they could be physically real. They came out from under the ground to torment the living. And of course, you know, in European folklore, you have trolls and fairies and elves and dwarves and all these other things. Just like in India, you have the Naga people and so forth. So, you know, these are themes that are in every belief system, and it just seems like Shaver was tapping into this somehow, or else something really happened to Richard Shaver, and then he kind of extrapolated his own interpretation of whatever it was.
Okay, speaking of our own interpretation, and we're all prone to that. In fact, folks, you hear stuff here on the show, and you think about it. Maybe you call in with some questions, and you digest all the information, and then you decide what you think the truth is. Well, that's your version of that information. There's no other way to do it. So there's nothing wrong with that. And every time you hear a person giving their version of information, you don't need to jump on them and say, well, that's just your opinion. Well, what do you want him to do? You know, you want Shaver to give you somebody else's opinion? You know, it's his turn, you know. And same with you. When you call in, it's your turn, you see. All right, but speaking of one's own interpretation, you deal with all these weird topics all the time in your books, on your radio show, when you speak publicly, and I've been over looking at your art page, and there's a whole lot of weird stuff, what the world would consider weird stuff, in your art. For instance, the one that I used on my website is sort of a fantasy landscape. I think it's an alien landscape.
Yes.
How is that? I mean, why do you, with your art, why do you paint those kinds of things? What's behind that?
Well, you know, I mean, honestly, I mean, I'm a science fiction nerd, man. I love sci-fi. I love good fantasy fiction, pulp fiction. I mean, that's what I basically cut my teeth on. So I write fantasy fiction and pulp fiction in addition to doing the research that's nonfiction. You know, one of my first loves, obviously, is folklore, mythology, comparative religion, history, those types of topics. But at the same time, for instance, you know, in Caverns, Cultures, and Concealed Creatures, I start the book off by looking at the 19th and 20th century, the fiction. The fictional interpretations, even going back further, even going back to Dante, you know, and even further than that. But I look at the fictional interpretations of these same topics, these same archetypes. There's a lot of stuff about H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, you know, A. Merritt, all these Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, they all wrote about this stuff. And, you know, all that affects the collective unconscious, or maybe even the collective consciousness of people. I mean, our pop culture is affected by that. And so even if people aren't consciously aware that that these ideas are being fed to them through this stuff, they still get the idea. You know, Shaver was very much a pulp guy, for instance. He loved the pulps and reading science fiction. So how much was he influenced by things like this? Because, you know, Burroughs had already written the Pellucidar, Hollow Earth stuff, and H.G. Wells had already written about the Morlocks living under the ground and preying on the surface people, the Eloi, and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum.
That's correct. And we are influenced by absolutely everything we ever see or hear.
Yes, we are. And see, it's the same thing with my art. I mean, my art is about themes from folklore, mythology, ufology.
We have to step away for a break. All right. We'll pick up with the art when we come back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we shall return shortly. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and this time it is time to say welcome to those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour. We're delighted you're here, and my sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour, and my sincere deepest hopes, prayers, dreams, energies all toward the idea that you never suffer that tragedy again. We're talking with William Michael Mott this evening, and for most of the show, we've been talking about the subject of a book that he's got coming out this week. It's being republished and expanded, actually expanded and then republished, and it's about Richard Shaver, a really pretty pivotal figure in the whole thing of ufology and paranormal things. And we've learned some things. I've learned some things here this evening that I was not aware of. And I hope you have too. At the moment, we're talking about Mike's art. He is an artist and an accomplished artist. If you go to my website and click on the picture about tonight's show, it will take you to his website. And on his website, you'll find links to his radio show. You'll find a link to a page that's all about his art. You can look at his art. You can see his art. Links to the books that he's written. And I want to wrap up with the art thing, and then I want to go to the books and let you just tell us a little bit about the books. We talked about one a lot tonight, but I want you to tell us in a little bit about the other books, and then we'll open up the phone lines. So I had asked the question, you know, a lot of your art has to do with the sort of strange themes that we talk mm-hmm. about right here on the show and that we've talked about here tonight. And I said, how does that happen? And you were sort of explaining that to us.
Right.
And then the break took over. So go ahead and finish what you were saying.
Well, you know, if people go to my site, there's a link there. There's a little revolving script that shows pictures, and they can click on those. But right beneath that, there's a piece of text which will take you right to the page where all the artwork is. And what my publisher and I are doing, this is the same guy that is the publisher that's doing my books, we decided to make the artwork available because a lot of this artwork has been published as book covers, you know, all kinds of different stuff over the years, been in magazines, magazine covers, magazine features, you know, some of it's been in my books. So what we decided to do was offer this stuff as prints, posters. Some of the stuff is going to be on, you know, t-shirts, coffee mugs, that kind of stuff. But mainly, you know, for me, for years I've had people ask me, how can I get a print of this picture? This image that you created, how can I get a poster? How can I get a print? Well, now they can get one. You know, I'm trying to do things that kind of show a wide range. This is not everything, but it's a pretty good sampling of my work. I think that, for instance, you can see behind me here, even though it's kind of shiny because it's got acetate over it, these are some older prints that I actually had done on a digital printer, but these are not even of the high quality that these prints at this place are going to be. Here's one of my lake monsters. Now, this image appeared in Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures. It also appeared in Fate magazine for an article that I wrote in Fate magazine. Here's another one of my images has been published many times in different magazines. I did a whole series on these dirigibles or zeppelins that are exploring an alien world. So, you know, these prints are now available as art prints. Some of them, from what I hear, people think they're very beautiful, and I have others that are a little more disturbing. It just depends on what you're interested in and what you want to put on your wall. There are some pictures there of strange creatures. And by that I mean like a little picture of a what's called a big nose gray in the UFO literature, reptoid or reptilian, alien, a zombie. These images and a mantis alien. These images were actually created for Brad Steiger. Brad did a couple of books. I've contributed to both writing and artwork to Brad's books, and on his book Real Aliens, I created these images for him. And for him to use, and he used them only in grayscale, you know, small inset publication of these images in the book. But these are the full color images, high resolution. You know, it's just a wide range of things for people, depending on what they want. There's some sci-fi stuff, some pulp fiction material, some Cthulhu mythos type stuff. So hopefully there's a little bit of something for everybody there.
All right, now I'm going to get a little bit philosophical about the artwork, okay? With a question. I'm going to use me as an example. When I write a song, the sound of the song and the lyrics that go with that song are chosen. It's crafted because I'm trying to set an emotion. I'm telling a story, but I'm trying to set an emotion that goes with that story. So that, you know, I'm trying to communicate both the story and the emotion with the story to the person who's listening. However, I find in the comments that people make about the music that thing about the emotion, that's wide open. They have if you have 100 people, you're going to have 100 different emotional responses to the song. So do you do the same thing when you paint a picture? And then what kind of response do you notice?
You know, it really is very similar. I think, though, that with music, I think you're going to get a wider range of emotions. Just because music affects people so differently. You know what I mean? I mean, for instance, you hear a song that you haven't heard for 30 years, and boy, it takes you right back to the time when you heard it, you know, because it's just something about the way it affects your brain. With artwork, I think that, you know, you do try to create an emotional response. You use color and setting, and you try to create the mood using the composition and the color and so forth. And the same thing with photography. And by the way, I'll have some photography stuff up on the site soon. But, you know, with writing, fiction is more one of those things where you really have to set the mood, and, you know, you try to set the mood and have the effect that you want to have. Nonfiction, not so much. I mean, you may want to convey your message, or you may want to get some ideas across. But, you know, when it comes to writing the nonfiction stuff, I try to remain as objective as possible. I want to present, you know, just this is what I have found. These are the patterns that I see in this material. Make your own decision. I think with nonfiction, it's got to be like that. But with artwork, I think that it does evoke an emotional response. I'm not sure how wide-ranging it is, because, you know, you show somebody a snarling, you know, alien creature, that I think the response would pretty much be similar. Whereas the thing with the lake monsters, you know, I've had people tell me it's one of the most beautiful images they've ever seen, because it's very peaceful. You know, there's two adults and a juvenile together in the picture, and there's moonlight shining on the water, and it's a very still and sort of a tranquil scene. So it seems to have that sort of a soothing effect, even though it's a very strange subject.
Okay,
does that answer your question?
Yes, it's beginning to. no, it does about you know, how you try to communicate an emotion. So let me ask you this: have you ever heard responses from people that surprised you about the emotion they had with it?
Occasionally, with the artwork. Not always, but occasionally. And you know, one of the things that's always, I'll give you an example. Years ago, I did a lot of sculptures, and I used to create these creatures just for fun, you know, that looked real. I've still got some of them, like little trolls and goblins and things like this, and they look real. I mean, they look like they could walk across the room and, you know, pick up the pencil and throw it in the trash can. They look very convincing. And a lot of them have kind of bitten the dust over the years, over, you know, being moved around and so forth. So I just got a few of them left. But many years ago, when I was in college, I created the first one that I really did. He was big. He was like 3 feet tall. And he looked pretty real. And he even had clothing and fur and leather. And he was a troll. And he was holding a spear. And I was in a college town, and I worked at a photo place, and I took this thing up to work one day and stood it behind the counter, and everybody thought it was very amusing. People come in, oh, that's really cool, you know. And this one woman walks in, and she looks back behind the counter, and she sees this thing standing there, and I mean, she looked like somebody had thrown cold water on her, and she kind of drew herself up and stopped, and she just stood there tight-lipped, you know, and then she said, "That thing is demonic. It's demonic." And she turned around and walked out of the store. Okay. So I didn't see that coming. It was actually it was actually based on something I was writing at the time, some fantasy fiction. And I had created one of the characters I had written about. But that was a surprise reaction. And all I can say is it must have been a success. Because, well, yeah. You know, the way I look at it is, either you like it, you love it, or you hate it. just don't be indifferent to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
But, you know, I think I am indifferent about maybe it's because I'm jaded, you know, by this time in my life. But I am indifferent to a lot of music, and I'm indifferent to a lot of art. It takes a really, really good song or an exceptional piece of art to get me to stop and say, wow, you know, and to have a reaction with it. Fortunately, there's a lot of art out there like that, and it's not the majority, but there is a lot of art out there, a lot of music, not the majority, but it is out there. And as I was going through some of your pictures, I went through all of the pictures that are on that web page. But as I went through it, some of those pictures really were wow moments for me because things that we've talked about here on the show. And you know how you said you hear a song from way, way back, you know, 30 years ago, and it takes you back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked at these pictures, wham, I was back in that show, you know, and wow. I was like, wow, I wish we'd have had this picture then, you know.
Right.
All right, I'm going to open up the telephone lines. You and I will continue to talk, but we're going to open up the telephone lines and invite the audience to join the conversation. You do that, folks, by picking up your telephone and by dialing this number, 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you're east of the Rockies, it's 623-444-5889. West of the Rockies, 623-444-5889. And if you're right on top of the Rockies, same number. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Steve from way east of the Rockies in southwest Georgia.
Hi, Steve.
Kevin, listen, I don't think jaded is the right word for you to apply to yourself, really. You know, I think you know, when you're accustomed to dealing with things of a specific energetic nature, you know, and when your consciousness and awareness is so far distant from mainstream humanity and what they're fixated on,
mm-hmm.
that the things that feed them, the things that they enjoy and find entertaining, don't even speak to you. And that your energetic field will resonate with things that are way outside the normal. So it's not so much jaded, it's that your sensitivity moves in a whole different arena. And so don't refer to yourself as jaded, please.
Okay.
And Mr. Mott, you are truly one of the more fascinating guests that Kevin has, and they're all fascinating in their own way. What I appreciate about your work and what you do is your point of departure, which is deep within the human experience. I mean, way deep within the human experience. And it's something that resonates with a part of us that is often submerged, you know, down into a well that, you know, we've been programmed and trained to stay out of. You know,
that's right.
We don't access that part of ourselves anymore. And there is so much power and so much energy locked up there. You start there and then you build on it. And you like Kevin, you know, you live in a creative energetic field that enables you to track down unique figures like yourself, you know, and Richard Shaver certainly is one of them. And I want to thank you for introducing him to me tonight. I'd never heard of Richard Shaver, but it sounds like he belongs in the same constellation with Philip K. Dick and some of these other guys that... Golly, if Philip had lived another 30 or 40 years, he'd be independently wealthy today. And he's a poor sucker, you know, that lived on the edge of poverty every day, kind of like Kevin does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Philip K. Dick actually, in a lot of ways, was very similar to Richard Shaver. I mean, some of his dystopian views and his distrust of authority and all that type of stuff. But, you know, the thing about it is that sadly, it's true, you know, we all have our struggles, and you'll find that it's just like with Shaver now. I mean, his paintings are selling for, you know, pretty good sums of money. He couldn't give them away. He literally couldn't give them away when he was alive. And it's a sad statement about our society that you know, nobody realizes what they have, whether it's a situation that they don't appreciate or a person that's not appreciated until that person or that situation is gone. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm grateful, you know, as a result of writing the things I do, and it really kind of kicked me off. I came up from three different directions, because I was writing fiction, nonfiction, and doing the artwork, and they were all going places at the same time over the years. But you know, they all have kind of coalesced together, and it's really because of people like Kevin and other radio show hosts and people that I met along the way in publishing and in the alternative realm of writing and researching and things like this. We all support each other, and if it weren't for people like Kevin and you know, some other people out there in Radio Land and some other publishers, you know, we all help each other out, and I think that's very important, because we appreciate each other while we're still here, and I think that's a big part of our whole experience with what we do. That's why we do it. That's a large part of it.
And truly, we are a very small and exclusive community of people. Not by choice, you know. It's not
right.
It's not like we have a club where you have to have a magic handshake or a magic word to get in the door. It's just you know, you have to be able to think certain thoughts and be courageous enough to step outside the little box that society wants to squeeze us into, to think the kind of thoughts and go where people go. And and one of the more important tools, and it's one that you deploy very well, obviously, Mr. Mott, is the faculty of imagination. And every major advancement, whether it's in technology or art or literature or anything, any major advancement uses imagination as a major tool to step into a new direction. You know, because every inventor, even if it's hard science, you know, they start with an idea or a vision, and then they use their imagination to create something that didn't exist before. You know, because you can't just go by the pre-established patterns and create something new. So
that's right.
Imagination is something that has been vilified and minimized in our culture. Oh, it's all in your imagination. Just automatically negates something. Well,
right.
How about it's all in your imagination really validates it? You know, and okay, that's a good imagination. Now build on it. Let's make something real out of it. So,
I think that a lot of that is based in fear. Whether it's you know, some of the more out there topics that Kevin has on his show and that I write about in my nonfiction stuff, or whether it's you know, any number of things, people react to things that aren't within their social set, their social norm, or the way mom and dad raised them. The instant reaction is, okay, that's a threat to my worldview. That's a threat to the way I was taught to think. That's a threat to my understanding of how the world works. And the first reaction is fear. The second reaction is to push back against it. And I think that you see that a lot with all these topics.
Let me throw something in here. See, everybody is going to have a reason for why they either like, love, or hate your work. And here is what speaks to me about it. With the art. Okay, now the books... Hey, all you got to do is read them, folks. Just read them, and they'll blow your mind. But with the art, every artist is painting some emotion. There's some emotion behind whatever they paint. But not all artists have any actual thought that goes with the emotion. And with your art, it's very evident that there was emotion being communicated, but also that there's some pretty deep thinking that went behind that. And in some cases, pretty solid information and data that went behind it. And then you applied all of that with the emotion to the canvas. So, I mean, that's the way it looks to me, and that's how it communicates to me. What do you think, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's very clear that what he's painting is what I would call an inscape. you know, more than a landscape. You know, there's the internal landscape of the soul, you know, which is in total violation with what do we call it, behavior science today. Behavioral science that psychiatrists engage in start off with the assumption that there's nobody home when they look at an individual.
Yeah, there's nobody home.
And if they'll go look in the mirror, they'll know they're right.
We're a series of responses to stimulus. That's all. Mm-hmm. And there's nobody home.
Yeah. Steve, I got to run along, man, but as always,
thanks, man.
Great thoughts.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. And, you know, if you are outside of the USA and if you're outside of Canada, then we realize that's an international long-distance call, and we realize that can be expensive. So we have an additional option for you. If you're outside the USA and you're outside of Canada, then you can go over to my website. If you don't want to make the international call, just go over to my website and look for the picture about tonight's show. Hard to miss it. It's huge, right across the screen. Right above that picture is a link that says flash message, and you may use that. If you are in the USA or Canada, it will appear to you that it's working, but if that originates in the USA or Canada, it won't show up on my screen, okay? So outside the USA, outside of Canada, call us or use the flash message. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
I know this isn't your particular field, Michael, but you brushed on it. The revelation about the wiretapping thing?
Oh, that is his field.
Okay.
His show, he will go into the conspiracies and even some of the politics, but we don't hear. But go ahead.
Yeah, we make people angry sometimes. But go ahead.
As soon as they made everything go digital, that's when I knew we were in trouble.
Oh, yeah.
It was actually before that when they started doing digital, but as soon as they did digital, everything's open to them.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'm glad you said that because, you know, my books are published both in print and in digital form. And some of them have been in digital, and they're still working on the print version. For instance, this Shaver book has been out in digital for a while, but we're finally getting... We want to do the print the way a print book should be done, so we're taking our time and doing it right. You know, and there's another one out there that we're going to do like that. So... Basically, when I saw the whole thing coming with the print...
Brent, hold the line, and Mike, hold the line. We got a break taking over, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, William Michael Mott. On the telephone with us, I hope still with us, is Brent from Wyoming. Brent, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, he's here. Okay. I had to cut you off in mid-sentence, Mike, so go for it, man.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, when all this started, I mean, back in the 90s, I actually was one of the first people to put out a little weird magazine in PDF, and then I tried a thing with publishing books PDF, and it just didn't hit. It wasn't time. And so, you know, I thought, well, we'll just wait and see what happens. And it's happened. But my concern even then and even now is that, you know, once you go digital with a book, you definitely want to get this thing in print and keep it in print if you can, because once it's just, if it's just digital, at some point, at some time, somebody is going to say, I want to edit this thing. I don't like what this says. Let's change history here. Let's revise this. He didn't say that. This is what he actually said. Oh, look, let's add this note. This is what he meant. You know, it's kind of like the people that want to go into Mark Twain and start taking out words out of Mark Twain's work because it might offend somebody.
Well, or theologians.
I'm trying to watch my language here, you know.
Theologians do it with the Bible all the time. Here's what that really means.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing is, though, once it goes digital, you can't stop them. If it's only available in digital form, you know, you're not going to be able to do anything about it. Sooner or later, the generation will go. Generations will pass. There won't be any more copies in print, and then, you know, how do you prove it? You don't. Yeah. Everything can be engineered, I guess is a good way to put it, socially engineered. So, you know, the same thing happens with everything else, all the data. I mean, with the whole, you were talking about the NSA thing, you know, with that, I mean, look, there's the saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and that's true, because, you know, I'm sure that these guys have done some good things and they've stopped some bad people from doing some bad things. I have no doubt about that. But at the same time, it's just like you don't frisk grandma at the airport, okay? Let's apply some common sense here. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the Constitution and go by it, because you're going to reach a point where you're going to have somebody at some point, and I happen to believe it's already happened, but material is going to be taken and used to blackmail people in positions of authority, whether they're generals, whether they're directors of agencies, whether they're people sitting on Supreme Courts. Things are going to happen. They're going to be like, look,
just think what they can do with a show. Let's say that they have all of my shows downloaded, mm-hmm. and they've got Brent. Where he calls them the powers that wanna be, okay? Mm-hmm. And they decide they're gonna target Brent. And good so they'll say, okay, well, you know, this guy is totally anti-government. And look at how many times he said this in public, on the air, and then he said this, and then he said that. They have a record of everything where it's taken out of context.
Well, not exactly. Well, not just that, Kevin, but he looked at these Facebook pages. He got email from this person in Brazil and this person in South Africa. And by the way, I'm saying that because I get emails from friends in Brazil and South Africa.
Yeah.
You know, this person in Australia, you know, and this person has these beliefs, and he sent him an email, and, you know, so-and-so's name was mentioned. And, you know, this is a pattern of being subversive, you know, and you have these things happen. And then you take that even one step further and you realize that with digital technology today, you can literally create conversations from thin air. You can create images in Photoshop or even video editors. You know, I mean, they can do whatever they want to now. That's what's scary.
Take, for example, what you could paint about me. I know diplomats and I know other types of government officers, and I know military people, and I know police from all over the world because I was international police, and I know them personally because I worked with them. So I get email from people like that. And so just imagine the picture that they could paint if they want to.
They can paint any picture they want. And what you have to do at this point, you have to hope that the right people are sitting behind the terminals.
Yeah.
Okay. And look, I know there's good people, but look, there's always a rotten apple in the barrel. Always. Yeah. There are always more than one who have their own agenda.
Here's the problem with that, too. You put one rotten apple in a barrel full of good ones, and I can tell you with 100% certainty which way that's going to go. They're all going to rot eventually.
Sooner or later. Yeah. And on top of that, when you have, let's just say that you have others in authority who might use such agency powers in the same way that apparently the IRS has been used to target people, because it has. Except now we're talking about other agencies that are even much more powerful, much more powerful. People don't realize how powerful they are. You know, when you have people using them to do their dirty work, you got a real big problem.
Yeah. Brent, did you have another question or comment?
Just want to tell them to keep up the good work. Keep up the good fight, Michael.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. And folks, how does that tie in to the world of the strange and unexplained? All this stuff about the NSA? It really actually does. Do you remember the show I did just a week or two ago where I talked about the whole machinery of secrecy around UFOs, extraterrestrials, anomalies out there on other planets, the fact that there are other planets in our solar system? There are definitely other planets in our solar system that you haven't been told about. And I documented that for you. Me and Robert Morningstar did that in a show we did about, two, three years ago, where we read for you, and then I provided you the PDF printout of it, where the International Astronomical Union annual report 1 year said that several minor planets had been discovered in our solar system that year, and that they had decided to, and I quote, suppress that information. And that was in their annual report. They published that. All of that secrecy, all that stuff, the machinery of that has just grown and developed and infected every part of our government. So that they're using the same means and methods, they're using the same machinery that was first developed around UFOs, extraterrestrials, and space anomalies. They're using it to gain power and control. I've said, and Mike, I want to get your response to it. I've said it many times. People say knowledge is power. Horse pucky. Secrets are power. Knowledge is freedom.
Secret knowledge is power.
Well, you can't have a secret unless there's knowledge there. So,
yeah.
But secrets are power. It's knowledge that brings you freedom.
Right. Well, you know, in any area, I mean, we've all heard the stories about the guy who invents the miracle working carburetor that, you know, is going to revolutionize the combustion engine, and then he ends up dead in his garage with his head smashed in, and his stuff is gone. I mean, we know this has happened. It's not a fantasy. Things like that happen because knowledge is power. And
well, secrets are power.
Threaten somebody else's knowledge.
Secrets are power. Knowledge is freedom from the secrets. When you expose the secrets.
Let's put it that way. He was about to reveal a secret that was a threat to somebody else's power. So, you know, whether it's that or whether it's, for instance, you talked about the UFO thing, and you know, I talked earlier today, you know, before the show, and I talked recently with somebody on my show, actually last weekend, about this. But, you know, this all goes back, a lot of the secrecy stuff goes back to World War II when the Germans were working on their Bell device. And, you know, how much of what goes on now is actually from somewhere else, and how much of it is actually some sort of breakaway civilization or breakaway sect of the Third Reich? You know, how do we know? You have Nordics. You know, you have actual verified cases where people claim that they heard UFO occupants speaking German.
You can document the fact that we pretty much wholesale brought those Nazi scientists here. It's called Operation Paperclip.
Paperclip.
And the thing is, We couldn't get off the launch pad, folks. We could not get rockets off the launch pad until
Wernher von Braun.
When the Nazis showed up, and, you know, we kind of, you know, dipped our fingers in unholy water, sprinkled them, and said, okay, you're good Americans now. And they showed up. Then we started getting rockets off the launch pad real quick. Mm-hmm. And we weren't, there was no space race. We were already beat. The Soviet Union already had something in orbit, a satellite in orbit, before we could even think about getting to orbit. And so, you know, the NASA, maybe today, I'm not saying everybody at NASA is Nazi. That's not what I'm saying. But NASA was a continuation, pretty much, of the Nazi science program, space program.
Well, Wernher von Braun was brought directly as part of that. I mean, he pretty much pioneered the whole thing, and he was a Nazi rocket scientist. And
major in the SS.
It's not a secret, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing about it is that, you know, when you're dealing with these things, you have to ask yourself how much is disinformation and how much is real information. I mean, it would obviously, there's a certain element of disinformation in this whole, in that whole field, meaning ufology. I mean, how many times when they were working on the stealth bomber, the stealth fighter, did people see these things and describe them very accurately, but they called them UFOs? They were being test flown. You know, and so now when we see things, we really have no way of knowing.
Well, a UFO, not, in fact, you know, they are UFOs if you don't know what they are. But exactly. That doesn't mean
and
they're alien
spacecraft.
This may
be some 10th generation experimental flying thing that we have no idea that that's what we're doing, but we're doing it. So, you know, we have no way of knowing.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, if it's in the air and you don't know what it is and other people around you have never seen it either, it is a UFO, but that doesn't mean it's alien.
That's right.
But, here's the thing, though. The term UFO was coined and became popular as a result of a book by Edward Ruppelt, and he's the first one that I know of that put that in print, unidentified flying object. But here's the deal: those things have existed all down through history. Long before there was even the Wright brothers airplane. And their existence was co-opted by the intelligence community here.
Exactly.
And they said, we'll just use that as the cover story for all our black projects.
Well, not just that, but since people always scoff at that, mm-hmm. ridicule it, dismiss it, it makes the perfect cover story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you can't have a cover story that is something people had not already seen. So
where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah. And so I hear people say, I love this one. You'll like this too. 95% of what's out there, people are calling UFOs, 95% of that is our secret military stuff. Do you realize there's not even a possibility that statement is true?
I'd say it's more like 10%, 5%.
The thing is, anybody that tells you it's 95% is tacitly claiming that they have the knowledge, access to the information, to be able to say that and for it to be true. Well, if they had that access, their clearance would be so high, there's no way they'd be out there saying that. We've got to take a break.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking this evening with William Michael Mott. And we are just about out of time. We are now into final approach. Let me remind you of our telephone number, 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. So if you have a question or if you have a comment that you would like to make to Mr. Mott, then dial that number or use our flash message feature if you're outside the USA and outside of Canada. Mike, I was just saying as we went away for break, people that say, well, 95% of that stuff is our black projects. The very statement itself, the very existence of that statement tells you it's false, because that person would have to have clearance to know all of the black projects and all of the test flights.
He wouldn't dare speak about it.
Not but once.
No, exactly. And he, much deeper than this guy that's going to Hong Kong. I mean, that is the secret right there that would really cook your goose if you talked about it.
Yes, it would.
But you know, and, you know, that happens all the time, is what I was saying. I mean, you have people who wax authoritative on any number of topics, and usually they're very dismissive in their final approach to these things. I mean, whether it's, you know, unknown humanoids, alternative life forms, even here on this planet, ancient civilizations, on and on and on, things for which there is significant evidence. But they will they'll do their best to wax authoritative in order to dismiss it, to ridicule it, to minimize it, because either they have an agenda that's driven by somebody else, or, as I find so many times, they just find it personally threatening, distasteful, unpalatable to even consider such things, because their own sense of security is threatened if they do. So they go through all these convolutions to attempt to dismiss things that they don't understand, that they have no knowledge of. And I just think it happens in ufology. It happens in every topic that's out there like that.
Well, on both sides of the fence, you have that. You've got people who are not dismissing it, but who are waxing authoritative on something for which there is little to no evidence, and they're doing it in favor of a particular view about that. For instance, UFOs. I'm just going to make something up for the example. All UFOs come from planet Zeton, all of them. And by golly, you know, if you think it's something else, well, you're nuts. And they wax authoritative on it. I think people that do that either need to take pills, or what they need to do is go ahead and expose themselves as tools of disinformation, because they're setting up something that can be easily knocked down, easily proven to not be true. We got a telephone call. Let's go ahead and take the call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. How about that?
Oh, I must have been from Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah, that fried the lines. But, you know, disinformation operatives will often set up something fantastic and speak authoritatively on it so that it can easily be proven to be untrue.
And well, you know, on top of that, Kevin, I mean, there's a certain amount of, there's a certain element out there which has to ask if it is it intentional obfuscation, or is it just like, just happens to happen, where you have these people that make these outlandish claims with no evidence. Like, you know, that my thing is, I'm very leery, if not downright dismissive, of so-called channeling and channeled evidence, because it's just, there's no way to prove it. It's just
okay.
Let
me break in and tell you that since we had that thing happen on the telephone, what happened was it messed up your audio, and we're still able to hear you and understand you, but it's very crackly now. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Okay, the caller's not there. I'm going to give it just a moment because a caller is listening to the radio and there's a delay. Listen to your telephone because you're going to miss this opportunity. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Well, I hear me back there. Okay. If you call me on the telephone, listen to your telephone. I see lots and lots of people inside the community doing things and saying things that to me looks like a setup. We'll try it again and see. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hamilton, Wisconsin.
Okay. Give us your first name again.
Michael.
Okay, Michael, go ahead. You'll have to be quick.
Yeah, I'm just calling to say this is my first time listening to the show. I read Mott's book, Caverns, Cauldrons, Concealed Creatures, back in, I believe, 2006. And since then, I've had a very large fascination with Hollow Earth and subterranean lore. So this was really an interesting show for me to listen to. I'd like to thank you.
All right. Well, listen, don't let this be your last time to call us.
No, certainly not.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for the call.
Take it easy.
All right. Okay. That probably will have to be our last call. Let's mention your other books again so that people will know what they're about.
Sure. Can you hear me okay right now?
Well, it's very, very garbled. Tell you what we're going to do.
I will speak slowly. Can you hear me better now?
Nah, it's not going to be good enough for broadcast. So I'm going to hang up and call you right back and see if we get a better connection. Pretty weird that happened when we got that telephone call. Maybe coincidental, but I mean, it fried his audio right then. So, let's just see what takes place. Okay, go ahead and tell us about your books.
Sure. Yeah. My books are, they kind of run the range, from fiction to nonfiction. And I have, as the caller mentioned, a book called Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures. It's now in the third expanded edition. It's just chock full of all this kind of stuff and looks at it and where it comes from and where it may be going. And I also have the Shaver book, which is about to come out again in print in a new and improved edition. It's already out in an ebook form. All my books are in ebook form in addition to print.
And what's the title of the Shaver book?
It's called This Tragic Earth, The Art and World of Richard Sharp Shaver. And the new link will be up on my website in the next few days. The electronic edition is already there. And I have a book called The Pulsifer Saga Illustrated Expanded Edition. And it's illustrated by me. It's two fantasy novels. They're highly satirical. They're kind of in the vein of Jack Vance or Fritz Lieber. People seem to really like those a lot. And they're definitely not politically correct. So I just want to warn you about that. But it's called The Pulsifer Saga. Mm-hmm. It's in print and ebook format. And then I have another book out there called Pulp Winds, which is in ebook format and will be back in print soon. So I have another book, which is the only book I have from a different publisher, which is called The Problem of Density in Regard to Non-Human Encounters. And it's a serious sort of a quantum physics look at some of this stuff. And that book is published by Tim Beckley. And that's something that is related to the very talk that I gave on the iConference. It's basically that theme, but expanded greatly and put into a book format. So those are the books that I have out there, and you can find all those at modamorphic.com.
All right. That's going to wrap it up for this evening. I wish we had more time, but we do not. And so we're going to have to say goodbye to our guest, but stay on the line with me for a moment, Mike, as I bring this in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it, William Michael Mott. And what great information. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You may call me whatever you wish to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.